following interview with Archie Bolster by William Burke took place in Falls Church, Virginia on February 23rd, 1988. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Research Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
Okay, Mr. Bolster, can you tell me a little bit about your background? Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in Iowa and then grew up in Montana, but when I was a relatively young 12-year-old, I went off to live in Iran with my father, who was the first agricultural attaché in Iran after the war. And we arrived in Tehran in January of 1946, having come through Port Said and Cairo, flown up there on military planes. So I had that 2.5-year experience as a young boy, leaving there in 48 and then going to live in Holland after that, where again my father was a cultural attaché. So when I graduated from high school, after returning from Holland, I had 1 year in Massachusetts and then decided to pursue a foreign service career. So I studied foreign relations at the University of Virginia, mm-hmm. in what they had at that time dubbed as their School of Foreign Affairs. And I went through the Navy program, Naval ROTC, so that as soon as I graduated, I had to serve my 3 years in the Navy. So I had active duty on a destroyer and went to the Mediterranean a couple of times. So I had some further travels, and during that time I took the Foreign Service exam. Then I joined the Foreign Service just after I came out. I left the Navy in June of 58 and joined in July of 58. Went through training and then had a special training in being a dispersing officer, which was a rather unusual type of job for a Foreign Service officer. Then I went off to Cambodia. It was my first post. I came back from there in 1960, and after somewhat less than a full tour, because I was ordered to language training at FSI for Persian language. And after finishing that, after a full 10-month course, after which I scored very well in the FSI system, and went off to my first post in Iran as a Foreign Service officer, which was Tabriz. Mm-hmm. So that was July of 1961.
If you had spent 2.5 years in Iran in the late, from 46 to 40?
46 to 48, yeah.
Did you go to school?
I went to the community school in Tehran, which is quite an experience in itself, because there were some 26 nationalities in the school. It was a real melting pot, but it was run by the missionaries, and the whole course was in English. So I really didn't learn any Farsi to speak of, a few improper words and some slang and some nouns and this and that, but a very mixed bag. So I really didn't know that much Farsi. I recognize, of course, speech patterns and sounds and some of these things, which probably helped me a little bit, but it was tough go learning Farsi from almost nothing in 10 months. But by the time I went out, the Foreign Service training, I think, was outstanding, because by the time I went out, I could go into any situation and talk with people in Farsi, whether it was a taxi driver or cabinet minister or whatever, just go in, conduct the whole thing in Farsi, and go back and write my report on the meeting in English. And I could pick up the newspaper and read articles, not as fast as I would in English paper, obviously, but I could quickly read the titles and decide which articles I wanted to read, and then go down and get key facts. If I needed something totally translated, then I would probably turn to the chief national employee and have him do it, but I could certainly read the papers and get what was going on.
Impressive.
And in fact, I still remembered some of the lesson plans that, you know, we had. They were so well written. They'd been redone a few years before I took the course, and they were so well written that they actually stuck with me and were used in such situations. Like there was one on a call on the Governor General, and you know, you use all the honorific terms and special high-flown Persian that you use with a senior official, and phrases about his province and things you wanted to find out and so on and so on. It was just very useful. They were things you used all the time. So the training was really excellent.
So back to this earlier period, what were your impressions of Iran as a teenager?
Well, I had pretty strong remembrances of it because a lot of important things happened while I was there. I suppose, looking back on it, the most significant one was hearing George Allen make a speech to the Iran America Society, at which he, in so many words, told the Iranians that we would support them in regaining their national territory, which was the signal that we were putting our weight behind the Iranians and getting Azerbaijan back. And it was also a signal to the Soviets, who, as you recall, when the chips were down, withdrew their support from Peshavari and Ghazi Muhammad. Peshavari in Azerbaijan and Ghazi Muhammad in the Republic of Mahabad. Soviets pulled out their support as soon as they saw we were going to back the Iranians, and then Shah sent the troops in, and there were casualties, but it was clearly the momentum on the side of the central government forces because they were given the clear support of the U.S. government. I heard Allen give this talk, so you know, that's even though I was young, it stuck with me. Also, another time I was on a trip, about the same time, in fact, I was on a trip with my parents to Karaj, which is a town northwest of Tehran, where there's an agricultural college. My dad had a lot of activities there with the faculty and various people. And on one trip there, we were coming back, and suddenly this military convoy was going toward Azerbaijan with the trucks full of troops, and towing howitzers and everything. That was the troop movement to Azerbaijan to regain their lost territory. So that was quite an experience. My dad experienced situations too, trying to go toward Azerbaijan because he made all kinds of trips out in the countryside to look at the crops and estimate what the production would be for that year and so on. And the Soviets stopped him. I think it was in Gazvin one time.
It was in early 46, I guess.
Yeah, and said you can't go any further. We're not going to allow you to travel here. So you know, there was quite an interesting period to be in the country.
What were your impressions of, or your recollection of the state of development of the country, economic and social?
Oh, it was really very primitive at the time. I mean, I saw the first traffic control they had ever tried. Simply a standard with red marks one way and green marks another way, and a policeman would stand in the middle of the street and turn it 90 degrees whenever he wanted the traffic to change, and people ignored him and just drove through anyway. And, you know, I mean, when I first came there, the main means of transportation was by droshke, which is a horse-drawn carriage, just like they have in some small Russian villages today. And they, you know, when you took a conveyance to go from here to there in Tehran, you took a droshke. And the whole appearance of the place had quite a similarity to parts of southern Russia. Buildings were not unlike buildings in Armenia or that sort of thing. So it was quite a strong experience. I mean, going to Isfahan, you know, all these kind of trips that we made were very dramatic in those days because there weren't that many tourists, and of course the shopping was, by comparison with later on, was fantastic because there were so few people in the country, so few foreigners, so you know, my parents did a lot of carpet shopping and shopping for other artifacts. My mother studied weaving and brocade making and things like that with Iranian teachers, and so it was a very exciting time. Learned a great deal about Persian society in different ways than I would later on when I came back as a foreign service officer.
Did you ever see the political figures of the day, the speeches like the Shah and Mossadegh or anybody like that?
I was never involved in that. I mean, my father went to a ceremony, the annual salam at Nowruz time when he met the Shah as one of the embassy officers, and his top hat and tails and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I was aware of all that, but at the age of 12 to 14, right, one doesn't get involved in many of those things. So I really didn't have that clear an impression of the politics of the day, aside from, as I mentioned, this U.S. support for Iran. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You said that after you were in the Navy, you went to foreign service school.
Right.
And you were trained in being a dispersing officer?
Yeah, I went through what they call A-100 course, which is a standard introductory course, and then they needed dispersing officers because they didn't have enough people. They just turned a lot of jobs into officer-level jobs, and they didn't have enough people who had the skills to fill them. This was just after the Ristin program, you know, when they... Henry Ristin.
Oh, Henry Ristin, yes, right.
The Henry Ristin Commission studied the foreign tourism in 51 and how to make it more representative. And,
early 50s.
Anyway, whenever it was, and the final recommendations were that, among other things, that we should be more broadly based and recruit people from all over the country, not have the exams just given in Washington, given across the country, and try to actively recruit people from various states and not make it an Eastern establishment, Ivy League kind of progression through Georgetown School of Foreign Service and so on. And a lot of people were moved from staff positions to officer positions more or less forcibly. I mean, they were just told, you know, if you want to stay in the service, you're going to become an officer and do this kind of work. And if you don't want to, then you know, we don't have a place for you anymore.
What is this about? Is this like for the foreign aid program, this first thing?
I'm just giving the background on the Ristin program now.
Okay.
So, in other words, when I first came in, some of the people I met were people who had worked for State Department domestically and had never been overseas, and suddenly they've been Ristinized, as they call it. My ambassador in Phnom Penh, Wade Trimble, had been a fairly senior person in Washington, but had never served overseas. He went out to Bonn as DCM, and from Bonn he went to Phnom Penh as ambassador. That was only his second overseas post, to be ambassador to a very difficult country, you know, dealing with Prince Sihanouk and all the machinations that he was doing. You know, it was really a tough job to follow all that, especially for a man who was fairly senior and who just come from Germany, where you have a totally structured political situation. Then you come to Phnom Penh, Cambodia, and try to deal with the mercurial Prince Sihanouk. It was really quite a challenge. So anyway, against all this background, I was probably, you know, in these cohorts of people who were coming in for the first time, sort of recruited from across the country rather than from Ivy League schools and so on. And I think I looked upon it, as many others did, as an opportunity to come into Foreign Service as more representative, if you will, of the broadly based Foreign Service than the one that had been there previously. Because, you know, in the 30s and 40s, on up to the late 40s, it had been pretty much of a
More exclusivistic.
An exclusive club, yes. Mm-hmm. And if you went to Harvard, Princeton, Yale, etc., you had a much better chance of getting into it. If you didn't, you had lesser chance. If you hadn't gone to college, you had no chance. And later, when they gave the exam, it was very democratic. I mean, now they had the exam before, but the exam was revamped and made much more general. Anyway, it's sort of a new period in the Foreign Service in the early 50s. And by the late 50s, it was still being digested, all these changes. And people still talked about, well, are you a Rispini, or did you come in recently? Or, this is sort of the argo of the service. In fact, if you look in the stud book, the bio register, you see some people came in 60s. And then when the FSO 6, and then when the Riston program took effect, they made it 8 classes, so the people went from 6 back to 7, for example, FSO 7, and then a few years later again they went back up to 6. So it was very strange looking career projections if you looked in the biographic register. But anyway, I went off, because they didn't have enough officer level people, they trained some of us in dispersing work, learning not to do it, because obviously you have people to do it, but to supervise it and be responsible for many millions of dollars and over the time that you're doing it in a post. And so I went out to Phnom Penh. I was one of two people in my entering class of, I think, 26. Only two of us went abroad on our first tour, which was our reward for volunteering for this strange duty of being dispersing officer. Their colleague went to Havana, Cuba, and I went to Phnom Penh, Cambodia. So it was a rather unusual job, but while I was there, I requested a chance to do part-time work in the political section, so I did some reporting on press and so on.
When you were dispersing officer, did you do a counterpart class or things like that? Was that some of the...
I dealt with everything, yes. Everything that was...
You're saying about what you're doing as a dispersing officer?
Well, I really paid every bill the embassy had. I mean, I paid for rental of space. I paid everyone's salaries. I paid all the bills for any service that the embassy got. Just anything that was required. I paid bills, for certain aspects of the military assistance when they were certified correct and so on. So it was quite a wide-ranging job, rather an unusual job to have, and a lot of money, a lot of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I supervised, I think, a dozen or so employees, and I had an assistant dispersing officer. You were financially responsible for everything you did until all those payments cleared, which took several years. There were thousands of U.S. Treasury and local currency checks over that period of time, and had to keep all of your accounts correctly reported back to the Office of Finance and negotiate with the local banker to work out services and that kind of thing. So, it was quite an interesting job, even though it was a non-substantive in terms of foreign relations or whatever, but still it had its aspects.
Did you also do some work at the political office?
Then I asked if I could, on a part-time basis, do some work in the political section, and to the extent that I was able to devolve some of my duties onto my assistant and my fairly well-trained staff, I was able to spend some time in the political section reporting on press, reading French language press and translations by the Cambodian, from the Cambodian press into French, and using those to write a summary of press developments, which the embassy was doing at that time. So, I've got a bit of a taste of political work, even though I was doing this dispersing officer job.
And you went to Tabriska and July 51.
Right.
From your training.
Right.
What were your duties at the consulate for that?
Well, we had a fairly small staff. We had about five Americans, if I recall, five or six. We had a consul who was in charge of the post, and a vice consul, and a political officer, and an administrative officer, and a branch public affairs officer, and an American secretary. I think it adds up to six. Mm-hmm. As vice consul, I was in charge of the post whenever the consul left on official business. And like a typical consulate, it had all kinds of varied activity. I mean, you could do some political reporting, although the consul did the lion's share of that. Mm-hmm. All economic reporting that was done from the post. All consular work, mm-hmm. although there wasn't much in a place like Tabriz. The administrative job of sort of running the post under the general supervision of the consul. When I arrived there, Bill Eagleton was the consul, and he was very actively engaged in researching a book on the Mahabad Republic, which he eventually published. And so he spent a lot of time in the Kurdish areas. And whenever he went off on these trips, I would be in charge. There were a few humorous moments because the procedure was that the field army training teams, so-called FAT teams, there were American field army training teams in various parts of Azerbaijan.
Part of Armish Mag.
Yeah. There was a field army training team in Mahabad, and there was one in Tabriz, of course, a large one in Tabriz, and I think there was one in Kermanshah. Anyway, various places. And the Mahabad team was obviously valuable to Eagleton because whenever he passed through there, he could call on them. And whenever they came by plane through Tabriz, if they could give him a ride to Mahabad for another one of his trips researching the Kurdish areas, both for his book and for
official duty.
Official duty, keeping track of how the Kurds were doing and all the political issues between the Kurdish tribes and the Iranian government and so on. The arrangement was that if they could take him on a trip by plane, they would circle the consulate compound twice and then head for the airport. So Bill kept a suitcase packed, and whenever we'd hear this plane coming, we'd rush out and look to see if it was the Armish Mag plane. They would circle twice, and Bill would run to the house, the consulate residence, grab the suitcase, and the consulate chauffeur, and off he'd go to the airport. And I would be left in charge with barely a word of what was going on or what I needed to do. So I just had to take over and run the post while he was away. Which was fine. I mean, you know, I really enjoyed the variety of duties that I had. I particularly enjoyed what came later, which was the land reform program, which started in Maragay, which is in our consular district. So I was the first person to report officially for the American government on all aspects of the land reform program, other than the purely political. I mean, the consul, would do the reporting on the larger political issues of land reform, but I did everything else. I reported on what it was like at the ground level, the procedures whereby government officials were coming out to the area to survey the situation and how they were deciding what lands were surplus, what was going to be confiscated from the owners, and how to divide it up among the peasants. And, you know, a tremendous number of issues were coming up, and I was able, because I spoke such fluent Farsi, I was able to go down there on trips and simply go and interview all these people. Visit the villages, talk to the head man of a village, or talk to other villagers, and, you know, ask them about their experiences before and during land reform. Fascinating. You know, I mean, I really formed a very good basis, I think, for analyzing what was going on, because I could see all aspects of it, and because I, now of course, I didn't speak Turki, which is the Azerbaijani Turki, which is the sort of argo of that area. Nor could I speak Kurdish, so if I got into a Kurdish village, I wouldn't be able to speak with people there. I couldn't speak that much Turki, although I learned some words, and I could say numbers and some simple concepts. But still, Persian was the lingua franca of the area, because an official coming up from Tehran to work on land reform would obviously not know Turki, so he would have to speak to villagers in Farsi, and they would in turn speak to him in Farsi, to the extent they knew it, either polished if they were educated, or very rudimentary if they were peasant. But, you know, most people with any education at all would speak some Persian, so it was a pretty easy way to communicate with people. And if I needed translation of Turki, then one of the consulate people with me, my driver or consulate political advisor, could translate from Turki to English.
Who was the political officer at the place at this time?
Johnson was the political officer.
You call it Christian?
Woodson Johnson. Yeah.
And there's also a public relations person there.
A branch public affairs officer, John Clayton, who represented the USIS activity in that whole area. And we had branch public affairs officers in each consulate. And they did all kinds of things like sponsoring cultural programs, and they had film teams that would go out and show USIS films to villagers on long swings through the countryside. You just go into a village and announce there'd be a movie that night and set it all up and show these films. Some were public health type films, you know, telling them about how to combat certain diseases. Some were with a certain public affairs message to them, maybe a slight propaganda tinge to them, but, you know, generally pretty well done, and fascinating to the villagers who had never, I mean, a lot of these villagers never been to a movie, or if they had, it might have been one time in a town when they took a trip to the nearby large town or provincial center. But having a truck come to the village and suddenly show movies to the whole crowd, it was quite an experience for so many people. So there was a very active program at many levels. I mean, we were contacting everyone from the top government official down through provincial officials and going off to tour the countryside and going to villages. We had quite an active program there to really learn a lot about what was going on in the whole of Azerbaijan.
You were there about 2 years?
Just over 2 years, yeah.
What was it like, that city like in those days? What were social and economic conditions like?
Well,
a provincial town like that.
It was an extremely large city. I think in that period it was somewhere around 400,000 people, and yet it had a very small town atmosphere to it, because there just weren't that many big buildings. The downtown area was was quite well organized, paved streets and all that sort of thing. But as soon as you got away from the center, you started getting into unpaved couches or small alleyways. It was sort of like a farming town in the Midwest, but much, much larger. Mm-hmm. I mean, the atmosphere was the same, and on weekends people came in from the villages to buy things, and you'd be jostled along the streets by rather stolid-looking peasant types who, you know, just didn't even move aside for you. You know, they just sort of walk right down the sidewalk, going to where they were going. And you know, there was a, as I say, or I said before, it's quite similar to what you would imagine some parts of the Soviet Union to be like. You know, just thousands of illiterate peasants descending on this city for their needs on weekends. And yet Tabriz had a sort of a cultural cachet from the old days, because in the 19th century and on into the early 20th century, each crown prince of the Qajar dynasty was sent up to Tabriz for training. I mean, they had, you know, court musicians and court people who gave lessons in history and music and deportment and everything else. There was a sort of a training ground for the new leaders. And they were very proud of their role in the constitutional events of 1906-1907, when the Qajar emperor at the time was forced to accede to a constitution which limited his powers. Of course, the Shah always maintained that he was still serving under that same constitution, but obviously there was no limitation of his power to the extent that it was even envisioned in the 1906-1907 affair. But another little footnote to that was that an American student from Princeton, or graduate from Princeton, had come out to Iran as a teacher at the school in Tabriz, the mission school. Became enamored of this constitutional cause while it was underway, and he decided to join them despite orders to the contrary from all his superiors. And he was killed. He looked over a mud wall during one of these skirmishes between rival groups and was killed. And his grave was in a cemetery across the street from the consulate. And every year we used to have Baskerville Day. We'd go and, you know, give a few speeches about his sacrifice for the cause of the Constitution in Iran. So it played well with the local press, because they were still evoking the period when they had this major role in pushing through the Constitution. Of course, in years since 1906 or 7, Tabriz has somewhat gone downhill in terms of its importance in the country, and many of the people felt that the government and the Shah, or the government, whichever way they want to talk about it, but if they were being frank, they would say the Shah thinks nothing of Azerbaijan. He still thinks that we're not really loyal the way most other parts of the country are, because he still keeps in mind that we had Peshavari regime here, and when the Russians were controlling Azerbaijan, and sort of feels that we weren't totally loyal, and therefore he's not giving us the attention that we deserve, not giving Azerbaijan the attention or the funds that it deserves for development. And, you know, there was that attitude, which was one of the reasons why the Shah selected Maragay, or Azerbaijan, as an area to start land reform, because there was this perception that not much had been done for that area.
Mm-hmm. Now, around the time you arrived, mid-51, I think there was something in Washington about political, social instability.
in Iran generally. I think a few months before, Ali Amini had been appointed prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
And from the documents I've seen, there was something that there might have been a military coup against Amini in the early stages of his period as prime minister. How much concern did you, was evident to you when you, maybe before you arrived in Iran or when you were stationed in Tabriz, how much evidence of concern did you see about the problem of Iran being potentially being unstable politically? There was a lot of concern about the direction that things might take in the country.
Well, at the beginning, there wasn't a great deal of uncertainty, I think, because the perception was that Amini had been appointed because of American pressure. I mean, before I ever went out to Iran, I was reading press stories in our Farsi class, and the general impression of the Iranian press was that because of Kennedy's views on Iran, that it should be try to be a progressive country and so on, that we had more or less behind the scenes put the pressure on the Shah, and he had agreed to accept Amini, who would be a reform candidate. And then there was a predictable sort of backlash that, well, if Amini is put in by the Americans, then there's probably going to be pressure by the Soviets or other foreign powers or other unknown people who will try to undermine that. And, you know, there was always that sort of dynamic tension that whatever happens, there's somebody else who's going to try and undermine it. So there was a little bit of that. But in my early days in Tabriz, I didn't have any sense of impending political crisis or anything like that. There were various events, including later on an attack on students at Tehran University, and a lot of heads bashed in and that sort of thing. So that there was, in the news from Tehran, there was a great deal of periodic ferment and questioning and people wondering what's going to go on. But in Azerbaijan, things just went sort of quiet and on from day to day, and people didn't seem to be all that concerned about these various indications of ferment down in Tehran.
You mentioned this thing about the issue of U.S. pressure on the Shah to appoint a reformist candidate, like a reformist prime minister, like Amini. Is that from your experience back then? Was there, going through that story, that there was actual U.S. pressure? Or
I don't think so, yeah. But on the other hand, the Shah was always extremely well aware of what was going on here and what perceptions were in Washington. And, the fact that he, during his reign, went to a series of presidents, I mean, it's been really incredible how long, when you look back on how long he had a major role. We were dealing a lot of times with dictators or strong men who came and went, Sigmund Rhee and Menderes, and you can cite a lot of people over time that we dealt with, and Diem and Vietnam and so on, who came, had their day, and went, and the Shah went on and on for a long period of time. So he had a tremendously...
Right. Talking about the Shah and his durability, I guess.
Well, and his very great knowledge of what was going on in the States. I mean, he had perceptive ambassadors here. You could talk what you wanted about their backbone or lack thereof. I mean, they were all pretty much his creatures. Whatever he wanted them, they did. But they reported a lot of information back, and he also read widely and visited a lot of people. I mean, he had people coming in to see him all hours of the day and night. He was a fairly open person, despite the controls around him. I mean, he did see a lot of people at all kinds of weird times. So he was well aware of what was going on in the States and what people were thinking about Iran. And I know from the ambiance of the time that he was aware of Kennedy's feelings about support for right-wing leaders, that
they wanted to continue to have our support, they had to show that they were willing to bring some reforms into their government. So he didn't need to be pushed by the government to do this. He knew that this was something that was desired by the Kennedy administration. And I think that's why he appointed Amin E. He felt that Amin E. was well regarded, and he was. I mean, you know, when Amin E. was first appointed, there were a lot of favorable articles in the U.S. press about how the Shah picked this reformist prime minister, a man with all kinds of knowledge and training and economics, and who would do a credible job of reforming the country. So I think that's why he picked him. But as soon as he made one move like that, then the Iranians always thought of, you know, whose interest it was to undermine. And does the Shah really support him all the way? Having picked him, does the Shah still support him? There was always that question, is the Shah still behind Amin E, or is he sort of maneuvering to let Amin E go too far and then to be yanked out, at least eventually now?
Yeah. In this period, early in Amin's role as prime minister, he ruled by decree for a while. I guess the Majlis was dissolved, I think, sometime in mid-61. There was lots of agitation, controversy over this, by the National Front, by demonstrations against rule by decree and the dissolution of the parliament and so forth. Was there much opposition activity evident in Tabriz at all over this? I think you sort of suggested there wasn't.
No, it was quiet.
Yeah. Did the National Front have much of a presence in the town at all? The National Front people, was there any constituency there?
There was some, but I think it was minor. Many times people considered all these machinations in Tehran to be sort of foreign to their interests, and they weren't really bound up in it. I think what brought Tabriz and Azerbaijan into political ferment really was the Shah's reform program, because As commonsensical as some of the reforms sound to us, they were quite dramatic changes in a more traditional area like Azerbaijan. For example, the most controversial one in my area in Azerbaijan was giving women the right to vote. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just unheard of. You know, land reform sounds like a very revolutionary idea, but in fact it wasn't. It had been already tried and done to some extent during the Pishavari regime. He had redistributed lands to poor people and claimed that he was leading the way to effective land reform. So people, when they first heard about the Shah's plans for land reform, went, oh well, you know, we had some of this before, and Pishavari handed out lands to people he liked and took it from the big landlords and gave it to people who were beholden to him, so the Shah will probably just do something similar. And, you know, there was a lot of skepticism about the whole thing, but it wasn't revolutionary in the way that getting women to vote was. That was just something that Azerbaijan could understand. Because, you know, liberated women were not unusual at all in Tehran, but they were in Tabriz. And there were liberated women. There were women who were teachers at the university, and there were women who organized seminars on various issues or meetings in which they discussed women's rights. And, you know, there was some ferment along that line, but it was very carefully controlled. And most people just, you know, they thought of the woman's place as in the home. It's very simple. The man did everything outside the home. He even did all the marketing. And you'd see men coming back from the bazaar carrying, you know, all the food for a week, the main food that they would buy, milk and other merchants came around with carts and sold food right in front of the house. I mean, you'd have a guy come by, the greengrocer would come by in a cart, and women would come out with their tadors on and bargain with him for potatoes and things like that. But anything that required going to the market, going to the bazaar, was done by men. And the women stayed in the house. They went to see other women. The door, totally in clothing, and just went out in the street and then into the house. And off comes the door, and they're wearing a Paris gown underneath with the latest short skirts and high heel shoes and whatever, lipstick, whatever. But in the street, they're always covered up. Anyway, the idea that the Shah was going to let women vote was really incredible. I mean, I had one colonel who lived near me. I talked to him about some of these issues occasionally, sort of, you know, neighborly chat, and I said, what do you think about giving women some rights? He said, well, you know, it's a scientific fact that women only have half as much brain as men. And I think it's dangerous to give them the right to vote, because who knows what they'll do? I mean, they might vote for anything. They just don't have the brains that men do. I mean, this is a, you know, a colonel in the Iranian army had this view of women. So the idea that one of the Shah's reform points was giving women the vote, that was really a hard pill to swallow in Azerbaijan.
That's interesting.
The literacy corps, the health corps, the land reform, the houses of justice, so many things that were in his reform program, which was first, I think, 6 points and then nine, and
right.
12.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, it just grew like topsy, but women's rights were really the toughest one to sell in Azerbaijan.
They were trying to solve the problem, yeah.